So thank you for all coming tonight to the Commonwealth Clubs Inforum, which you can find online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. And you can follow the best of our dialogue on Twitter with the hashtag InforumSF. I am Peter Ha, the managing editor of TechCrunch. And tonight we're joined by a group of journalists and publishers from across the print and online media landscape. All of them are professionals working in a changing industry and have up-to-date creative opinions for how to approach the future of publishing. To my immediate left is Claire Jeffrey, who is the editor-in-chief of Mother Jones, a bi-monthly print publication with 8 million monthly page views. And to her left is... Oh, no. You guys switched places. All right. Lainey Witkneck, who is the chief community officer at Federated Media. And to her left is Mark Johnson, CEO of Zeit. And his left is Chris Taylor, deputy editor of Mashable. And they're here to give us the inside scoop on publishing and the revolution that's been changing the world and how we sort of get our media fixed. So why don't we get started? You know, the advancement of technology has fostered many a great thing, but things like social networks like Facebook and Twitter have effectively killed off journalism. What do you guys think about that?
Wow. I mean, I think it cuts both ways. In some ways, there's never a greater moment for journalism. I mean, whether it's covering things like the Arab Spring, the things that social media can do for us, the sort of instant feedback, the fact that we can break stories, the fact that a lot of documents are much more accessible than they used to be. If you're an investigative journalist like I am, it's a lot easier in some cases to dig into things. But at the same time, the revenue model for a lot of what we value about journalism is in trouble.
Yeah, Peter, I don't think it's a valid assertion. I mean, just because Twitter and Facebook exist doesn't mean that people aren't still producing news programs and writing articles. I mean, it certainly hasn't killed it. I mean, a really interesting tweet I saw a few weeks ago was from an 18-year-old friend, and she said, "I get all of my breaking news from Twitter." Now, I think that networks like our parent company CNN should be concerned about that the younger generation is getting their breaking news from Twitter. But what happens after you get your breaking news from Twitter? Sure, you're going to turn to something that's a little bit longer form than the 140 characters that you can put on Twitter, I think.
Well, Mark, don't you think that we're sort of inundated by so much throughout the day, whether it's on Twitter or Facebook or going to, let's say, CNN.com or Mother Jones or Mashable, at what point do we say to ourselves, I think I'm going to have to take a couple minutes to actually read the story instead of just skimming headlines on Twitter?
I mean, I think there are different types of people. I mean, look at the long form movement. I think that that's a really positive development. It shows that people, they're sick of the stories that just parrot one another. It's, everybody tells the same story. Really, what you want to do is sometimes see some analysis about that story. I think the clutter online is exactly why we need things like Zeit that try to figure out what you like. I mean, I think this is a huge problem. I mean, we are inundated every day with so many stories, and something has to be able to tell us which ones we ought to read.
Yeah, I mean, quantitatively, there is more content than there's ever been before. I mean, we know that. The amount of content on the internet, whether you call it journalism or not, is increasing exponentially. Now, how good is that? That's a matter that every reader gets to decide by themselves. My personal take is that, there's a whole lot of journalism developing at the extremes, which is the extreme of short form and long form. Mark mentioned the long form movement. The hashtag long reads. The Byliner is a great publication, great example of that. And the short form, you've got the quick hit, the quick news take. We're sort of, part of that movement. And, we also like the longer, more opinionated takes as well. Journalism is in crisis in the sense that it has to innovate and compete in a way that I think it never had to before, certainly in this country. I think it's a little different in the country I grew up in. Where we already had that kind of competition. We've already been through this. so we kind of know what lies ahead. And, you know, it can get ugly sometimes.
So I think, you know, one of the main issues is, especially with blogs and the traditional publishers sort of trying to compete with those blogs, is trying to get online first with the story, right? So, and that eventually comes down to, you know, clicks versus quality. I mean, is that, at what point do you say the quality of journalism needs to sort of surpass the clicks in order to say it doesn't really matter what our revenue stream is, you know, it's all about journalism?
I mean, I think it depends. Are you breaking a story that is yours to break, or are you just trying to be among the first to comment on something? Those are two very different kinds of things, and one of which is definitely journalism, the other of which is sometimes journalism. I think the issue that we all face is if you're in journalism today, you have to compete on all of those fronts. And so with much the same size staff, you are doing traditional long-form investigative journalism, you're blogging, you're doing breaking news, you're competing on social media, you're shooting video and all the rest. So that's just sort of it can be this wonderful synergy, but it can also just be this exhausting, you know, hamster wheel, as we like to call it.
I think there's another piece to that as well, which is that, you know, when you push out content onto these social platforms, right? The idea is that you're generating value by driving people back to your sites, but people are not able to monetize what they're pushing out onto those social platforms. And so what ends up happening is that, you know, journalists and content creators, independent content creators, end up in this sort of space where they have to keep driving people back and back to their site. But really what they're doing is they're fueling the growth of these social platforms and the well-being of these social platforms that have billion-dollar, you know, hundred of billion-dollar valuations. So there's something really broken there as well in terms of how we push information onto those social platforms and the ability to monetize the content there.
So, you know, each of our respective publications and whatnot, we work a little bit differently. But Claire, you're, I think, the only one really that has both the traditional print side of it as well as the web. So, you know, obviously clicks versus content is a major thing for you, right? So how do you get around getting beyond sort of what your revenue is just to get the story out?
Well, I mean, in some ways, we're a completely schizophrenic beast in that we have this, you know, bi-monthly long-form, mostly magazine, and then everything that the web and social media does. But, you know, a good story doesn't always find purchase, but it often does. And it just, you know, yes, you have to make sure that you post Facebook and what time's the best time to post Facebook and how many tweets are we going to put out about this story. But I think you can't really think about it as just assembling clicks. For one thing, I think the page view model is sort of doomed on a revenue front. And on the other, it's just like then we're all doing, you know, can I has a cheeseburger slideshow-y type things, which is really fun, and we do them too. But at the end of the day, there's got to be something more to what we're creating than just that.
Right. Mark, I mean, you're in a much different position, I think, than all of us. So what do you think Zeit does for journalism in the long run?
I mean, I see Zeit as a platform on which you can really innovate. I mean, right now we're trying to innovate both on how people discover content, how it finds people. I mean, you really want to get that content in front of the right kind of person, the person who likes long-form content, the person who likes a little bit more analysis. And if they have to sift through a lot of clutter to find that, you know, they might never find your piece. But I think simultaneously, it's incumbent upon us also to innovate on the business model, because frankly, the business model on the web has never worked. No publisher really wants to plaster their pages with multiple ads that perform poorly. The users don't like it. I mean, think of the old days of magazines when ads were actually a great part of the magazine. You read Vogue as much for the ads as you do for the content. And then I think, finally, as sort of on the publisher model, you know, how do we help publishers to monetize their content? So, I mean, we're kind of fighting battles on a lot of fronts, but I think it's important for us to do so because, you know, we've got the power of this tablet.
How do you hope to monetize how publishers, you know, how do you hope to share revenue with publishers?
It's something that we're still trying to figure out. I mean, honestly, I don't think anybody has the silver bullet yet. There's been a lot of models that have been tried. Nothing really seems to work. CPMs, so the amount of money you get for ads on tablets right now is inflated because of the size of the market and the quality of the user. But soon everybody's going to have a tablet, and CPMs are going to go back down to what they are on the web. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to find something in the next few years, but I think that it's important that publishers actually, you know, trust us a little bit and try to work with us and experiment, which is something typically publishers, you know, can have trouble with.
Do you see magazines on the iPad as a model? I mean, speaking personally, you know, I'm a big fan of The New Yorker, and I read it both online and in tablet form, and I notice the ads, you know, just as much in each format, and they're sort of, you know, gorgeously displayed in each format just as much as the other. So is that a good, encouraging sign?
Chris, I think so. I think that there are certain publications out there that actually integrate ads really well. But, you know, I'd like to see better targeted ads, ads that are more integrated into the actual tablet. You know, are there things that you can, you know, do on the tablet through ads? Like, can you send people to an app to download or some sort of app-to-app selling? I think there's a lot of interesting things that you could do that I don't see people doing right now. I mean, think the worst thing you could do on a tablet, which is this incredible computing device with a lot of power, is to try to take a magazine and kind of shove it in there until basically you've got a magazine on the tablet. That's not user interface innovation. That's just sort of taking something in an old model and trying to stuff it into a new one.
Although I think the danger is that if you expect users to interact with your ads, very soon advertisers will find that they, in fact, don't. So I might flip through the pages of Vogue and see a Dolce ad, but do I actually go into it and start ordering things? And once they figure out, like, I don't have the money for that, most people who read Vogue don't, will they still support the product? So it's just an interesting dilemma that I think we all face.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at traditional publishers like Condé Nast and Hearst and even Time Inc., you know, you look at what they do with their website properties, and, you know, they tend to hold their print publications on a much higher level. So the websites sort of suffer for that. Whereas, you know, I think for, I guess, blogs and what they've become, it's a much different story. But I think the larger question is, you know, why don't traditional publishers, why aren't they taking advantage of technology? I mean, you look at their websites, they're not that great. And if you look at their iPad apps, for instance, they're not that great either.
I mean, I'll take a stab at this, is that I think that most print publishers have failed on the web. The tablet should be seen as their savior, and if they don't embrace the tablet and figure out how to deliver their content on the tablet, I think that a lot of print publications are moribund. They're going to be gone in 5 years.
Although there was an article that came out last week, and I can't remember from the moment who wrote it, but just sort of the dismal actual rates at which people are opening and using their magazine apps. Like, a lot of people subscribed in the beginning, but they've fallen way, way off, even for the ones that were considered the big success stories, which I think is not encouraging. I mean, in fact, the Condé Nast of the world really embraced the very similar to the magazine they knew app, at, you know, not as soon as they should have, but eventually. But because it's so closed off from the rest of the web, and because maybe people actually subscribe to magazines and don't always read them, they're, you know, again, you get that feedback to the advertisers and to the publishers that people aren't, in fact, opening them.
But, Claire, couldn't the tablet really be an opportunity for kind of presenting that content in a completely different way? So extending the content, thinking about it just completely different, giving the user a different experience so it's not, to Mark's point, like just taking the magazine and putting it on the tablet, right?
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think ultimately they have to be kind of interwoven with the web. I don't think having a closed-wall app is, to my mind, the way to go.
Well, it's a great point, and I think an interesting publication that I've found that does this is Reader's Digest. You know, Reader's Digest had a very specific format on the newsstand, and on the iPad, what they've done is taken it and tried to create a lot of their information into interactive infographics and almost like game-like things within the publication. And that's where I want to see news design go. I mean, it's really about telling a story to people. It's about educating them. It's about helping them learn something new. And that's not always done through words. I think that one thing that I wish more publications were doing were adding developers to the staff. You know, maybe developers with a liberal arts background who want to help tell the story better. I think that would really help publishing a ton.
But Mark, couldn't advertisers and marketers also do the same thing, right, with the advertising that they're creating, right, mm-hmm. in that same vein of creating new experiences, creating new engagements, right? I think that's what you were speaking to earlier, right? There's just a huge opportunity with the tablets. Tablets are going to outsell PCs in 2 years. Everyone's going to have a tablet. Like that's where the thinking needs to go.
Right. I think we're just in the early stages of this medium. It's like, you know, the early movies before Birth of a Nation, it was all proscenium arches. You know, it was the theater on film. And it took more than a decade for filmmakers to figure out, hey, this is a new medium. We can do a close-up. We can do a mid-shot. We can do these action shots. We can do all these things. We're still at the proscenium arch stage with the iPad. We're just starting to figure out what this medium can do. And I think the same is true of the web. You know, we're just, you know, we're tinkering. We're kicking the tires. And I'm very optimistic about the future of media in general on these mediums. And sort of looking down the road much further afield, I think, you know, print and the web are basically going to sync up because, you know, our e-readers are going to get so small, so flexible, so disposable that they will effectively be the same as magazines. They're going to look the same. They'll be the same format. You'll take them to the bathroom. You know, it's there'll be functionally very little difference.
Well, let's hope there's not just print on it at the end, though, right?
Well, if you think about when the first Amazon Kindle came out, there was a lot of talk about how it was going to sort of revolutionize and possibly destroy print. But, you know, my thought has always been, you know, all of us here, I think, in this room, we grew up with magazines and newspapers and textbooks. You know, it's I have an affinity for paper, and I always will, because I think it's a generational thing. Until you get tablets in the hands of kids in kindergarten and first grade, they won't know any different. So even with the iPad and how well it's sold, and if you take a look at, let's say, what News Corp has done with the Daily, while it's been relatively successful over the last year, it's still not taking a chunk out of anyone's business. And at the same time, you know, it's still going by a traditional newspaper model. So at what point will tablets actually sort of advance journalism, become the future of journalism?
Well, Peter, I mean, to one of your points, I think that, you know, though I used to subscribe to a lot of magazines, today the only magazine I read on a regular basis is Hemispheres because it's in the back of my United my United seat, and I fly a lot. And I think that's a problem with even people of our generation who really like print. You know, we're not reading magazines anymore, and yet I consume way more news than when I subscribe to magazines. So I think the web even has started this trend even before tablets.
But I think, again, the problem is a revenue problem and ultimately a brand problem. I mean, you read plenty, or at least intend to read or favorite and think you're going to come back to read things through Twitter or whatever. But nobody really goes through the front door of any site now, which I think is part of the problem of these closed-door apps. But the problem with that is that how is the revenue going to attach to the entity that will hire reporters and fact-checkers? Mm-hmm. Hire lawyers. You know, people always forget. They're like, oh, well, we've managed to scrape together enough to pay the writer for this article. And it's like, well, that's great, but you need fact checkers and you really need lawyers for a story like that, and you need all these other things that are just not thought of. And I think one of the big problems that we're facing is that because advertising subsidized media for so long in a way that really made the true cost of what this takes completely invisible to the consumer. And so now we're in a situation where, you know, the reason that they're still in print is because that's the only place they're making money.
Claire, with all due respect, I think that's, in some ways, a very big media perspective of the world. I mean, look at something like Huffington Post. They have created an organization that has far more page views than most every major network out there, and it's done with a smaller, leaner staff. I think an example like Huffington Post is the perfect thing to look at, a Mashable, where they're doing more with less, and it's just an unfortunate reality of the situation.
They're not doing more with less, though. Mostly what they're doing is taking other people's content and repackaging. They have recently, in the last year or so, hired a bunch of very good reporters and editors, but the large, you know, like the Daily Mail, the large amount of what they do is they to a greater or lesser extent, aggregate or, in some cases, in the case of the Daily Mail, just wholesale rip off other people's content. So they're not doing more with less. They're just not. They're just making money off of it better.
Well, to give Huffington Post its due, I mean, they did, you know, they are to a large part an aggregator, but they also create a lot of original content. And there was a fascinating back and forth between Arianna Huffington and Bill Keller at the New York Times on this exact topic. And she kind of had the last laugh on that because, of course, one of her staff members won a Pulitzer this year. And I think that's sort of the model that you see over and over again in journalism. It's how Pulitzer himself, you know, made his money. You know, we had yellow journalism at the start of the 20th century, which was, you know, very sensationalist, very tabloid, but at the same time got a lot of great reporting done. And there's always been this tension between those two sides. I think that tension is still here. It's going to continue to exist in the future. There's the stuff that pays the bills, and then there's the stuff that pays for.
I would also say, though, Chris, I think that, and to your point, Clara, like, I think we do need to figure out kind of what the revenue model is for pushing that content and that content living in those huge social platforms, living on Twitter, living on Facebook, and the content creators actually getting or being able to generate revenue from their content being distributed through those channels. Because right now they're seeing no value whatsoever from that. And yes, it is a distribution. They are distribution channels, which is great, but they're still just pushing people back to a CPM-based website with a broken model.
So, you know, we've talked about CPMs and revenue models quite a bit so far tonight. So, you know, I wonder who is sort of at fault at this point. Is it the publishers or the advertisers for not sort of taking advantage of the internet or actually taking the time to figure out, well, what do we do with this thing? What do we do with this series of tubes that exists and that everyone's going to eventually be on and they're going to be looking for content?
I mean, Peter, I think advertisers have taken the first step, and it's kind of exciting. I mean, a lot of advertisers are creating content, whether that's funny videos on YouTube that go viral or creating their own sort of editorial content that is only indirectly related to the brand. I think a lot of advertisers are realizing that they're spending a lot of money on poorly performing ads all over the web, not just on media sites, but all over the web. And they realize that they need to figure out a better way to get mindshare. I mean, we talked earlier about how much content is coming at you, and that just doesn't affect publishers. It affects advertisers, too. So to rise above that noise, I mean, I think something like the Old Spice guy, like that's really cool, interesting content that's very compelling, and yet it's built by a brand.
But for every Old Spice guy, there are thousands of failed Old Spice guys, right? So I think we're in a really interesting place because advertisers are looking for scale and they're looking for return on investment, and it's hard to generate a lot of scale, or there are a lot of questions about how to do that with these more innovative and more interesting, models. At Federated, we do a lot of, what we call conversational marketing, and, that has taken us many years to figure out how to scale to a point that, you know, it's interesting and attractive to advertisers so that they can support the content that's being created by our publishers.
Lainey, I would say for every bad viral videos, I mean, think of all the bad, like, just commercials out there, right? You know, there's 7-Up, the Uncola, and then there's probably, 100 hours of really bad commercials that same week. So, advertising typically is a few ones that everybody remembers. That's why they're good. It's good advertising and a lot of corrupt.
But I would say with the scale, Mark, that we have now and the inundation and the of media coming from so many different sources, it's much harder to have that, Mean Joe Green, I can't remember if it was Dr. Pepper, whatever, the Diet Coke commercial from the 70s now, because there's just an inundation of sources coming at us.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, the advantage for the advertisers now is that they can really kind of micro-target markets in a lot of ways, but the potential disadvantage to them is that if something doesn't go as viral as Old Spice, I mean, it's just a lot of little bits of content they have to make for these particular audiences, and you know what brands can afford to do that. You know, maybe some don't need to, but if you're trying to be a large mass consumer brand, it's sort of the same problem that like Condé Nast faced. You know, how are you going to balance both those concerns?
So, you know, things like the Old Spice guy have done really well, but that's for a very particular brand. It doesn't really do anything for content creators, right? So the question is, you know, for me at least, you know, when I go to a website, whether it's Mashable, New York Times, wherever the case is, you know, you have these banner ads and you have these ads on the side that I just don't even look at anymore. I see them, I don't pay any attention to them, or I have an ad blocker on them. But unfortunately for us in publishing, advertising is how we make money. And we've been dealing with this for years, and yet nothing has happened. And you look at the rise of the iPad, and everyone's sort of like, oh, this is going to be the savior of print, of publishing in general. I mean, it hasn't really done anything. It hasn't had that big of an impact. So the question is, has technology even helped us?
I would say yes, it has, and I would disagree that it hasn't had an impact. I mean, we're 10 years in now to the Google AdSense era. I mean, I'm old enough to have been at Google in, like, you know, 2001, where they were trying to explain how they were going to rescue and innovate in internet advertising. And I rolled my eyes and said, sure, Larry and Sergey, sure, you're going to come up with this great new advertising model that nobody else has figured out. And that was an era where it was all banner ads, you know, prior to about 2001. It was all banner ads that nobody was looking at. And then they came up with AdSense, and this idea of targeted advertising was born, and text-based ads made a resurgence, as I think they have ever since Craigslist. And now we're in this pioneer era, this brave new world where we've got, you know, targeted Facebook advertising. I mean, I don't know if this is the same at TechCrunch, but at Mashable, we've got startups who are trying to attract our attention by telling Facebook, you know, hey, put this ad about, you know, covering our startup to anyone who says on Facebook that they're a member of Mashable. I mean, you know, this is a phenomenal new growth of advertising that we just could never have imagined a decade ago.
But don't you think that this in general, Chris, is it's the whole problem, because we're spending more time talking about advertising than we are about content? Mm.
That is a problem. And, you know, I like to be able to just focus on the content. But at the same time, you know, one of the things certainly that we cover is advertising. And it is a great story in itself. And you're driven by it. You know, it pays the bills. But at the same time, it's a heck of a story. When it goes wrong, it's spectacular. When it goes right, it's spectacular. I think you guys wrote today about the Nokia wrap?
I believe so.
It was a really, really bad wrap that Nokia came up with. I mean, you know, there are fails going on all the time, and there are successes going on all the time. So, yeah, are we perhaps a little too obsessed with the new formats? Sure, but I think it's a legitimate story.
Well, and also, I think correct me if I'm wrong, but almost all of the trends for how much revenue that kicks out are going down. So there again, I mean, I think that's the real question. It's not like, are there cool ads? Of course there are cool ads. There are great creative people out there. And of course there's great new media, but it's the things that used to be paid for that are less and less paid for. And so far everybody wants to solve that problem. Nobody really has made any inroads in solving that problem.
I think it's a good point, and I'd like to also suggest that maybe it's not just ads, right? You know, we haven't even talked at all about other revenue models. I mean, there are paywalls. I imagine micropayments are much easier, right? You can't imagine 5 years ago even, or maybe 10 years ago, that people would actually pay 99 cents for a single song. It's changed the way people produce music. And I think the same thing with publishing. Perhaps, you know, I trust Mother Jones, thus I will be willing to go on a limb and pay 25 cents, 50 cents, a dollar for an article that I haven't even read yet. I've only read an abstract for. And I think that publishers shouldn't just be thinking about advertising. They should really be thinking about other ways to generate revenue. In other words, ways to generate subscription revenue online.
Yeah, and I think that they are. And, you know, thus the paywalls have come up and gone down at every site, including ours, and up and back and up and down again. You know, and I think micropayments, as a nonprofit, I mean, we take donations, and so we already are in that business. And that may be where a lot of the sort of serioso journalism has to go, because it's just going to need to be underwritten by other entities. That has its own problems, but the sort of Kickstarter or micropayment thing, I think, also awaits a better, sort of more universally adapted infrastructure for that.
But how do you, as a publisher, how do you combat folks that will, let's say there's one person that does pay for something? What's stopping them from scraping that content and then putting it on their blog for everyone to see for free?
Right. Nothing.
Yeah, I mean, there is nothing stopping. I mean, the New York Times has a paywall, right? And it is simplicity itself to get around that paywall. I won't say exactly because, you know, there may be subscribers in the room, but, you know, if you chop off a certain part of the URL or if you go to it through Twitter, or, you know, there are ways of getting around it. But people still pay. It's just that nudge. The paywall is just a nudge towards better behavior. And it just says, hey, you know, there's good content here. Why not?
Right, and a lot of people want to support the Times, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I was begging my friends and editors. They're like, when are you guys going to get this thing up so I can stop getting the print version except Sundays when I still want it, you know, and finally they got it done, and it was, I mean, essentially it is people who were going to support it anyway supporting it in a new package.
You know. Look at NPR. I mean, let's not forget that NPR is funded more by individuals and corporations than it is by the government. And these are people, there's no paywall on NPR. They encourage you to go share that content with everyone, and yet people still feel compelled because they love NPR so much, they want that programming, that they're willing to pay. I mean, it's the problem with that kind of model is then you have to have really high-quality journalism. This does not work for a publication that produces really bad journalism. I think that, you know, this could be a saving grace of journalism, potentially.
Well, I think, you know, about 1 in 10 NPR listeners, regular listeners, ponies up. That's sort of, for our subscribers, about 1 in 10 gives us some amount of extra money. You know, that's not bad, but you reach a certain level of scale and you can start to see the problem depending on the kind of reporting you need to do.
I mean, do you think it's a lack of loyalty to a specific brand?
I think, again, I mean, I think people just don't really understand, A, what it costs to get it done. And, I mean, you know, if you don't have investigative stories run through lawyers, you will be sued out of business. If you don't have fact checkers, same thing. Whatever it is, if you're a journal of photography, it's not just paying the photographer. It's, you know, it's the travel. It's just so much more that people don't see. And I really do think that because advertising made newspapers in particular, but also magazines, much cheaper than they are in Europe, by the way. Like, papers and magazines are more expensive on average, and then I think, therefore, people got used to the idea of paying more for them. Now, that has been destroyed in other ways, but there wasn't this sort of basically giving it away model.
Right. You know, I'm curious to know long form versus, let's say, 140 characters, right? Again, it goes back to sort of a generational thing where we're all sort of used to reading the newspaper and magazines and novels and all these things, but kids these days, you know, they're on Facebook, they're on Twitter, they're looking at Tumblrs and this and that. So at what point do we have to say to ourselves as journalists, you know, we have to sort of dedicate ourselves to long form again and just sort of get rid of the short little quick hits just to get on the web first?
Well, I think there's, Peter, there's no reason why you can't have both. I think that the web needs both. I think people want both. There are different times of day. You know, in the morning, I like to check Twitter. I like to just get those quick hits as I'm going into work. In the evening, as I'm coming home from work, I want to settle into a longer read, you know, something that will last my whole commute. So we go through different cycles in the day. I think we go through different cycles in our lives where we want to read different kind of things. And I would also argue that it's not the 140 character versus long form distinction is not that much different from what we've always had. You know, newspapers have always had short, quick bites down the side of a given page. And the 140 character format itself is very familiar to all of us who have read a newspaper because it's headlines. You know, very few headlines ever go over 140 characters, right? And we're used to reading that headline, then clicking through if we want more. So
I think Twitter has also created this incredible opportunity for the news to actually have a dialogue with its audience. I mean, this is something that should not be forgotten. Like, you know, I follow lots of reporters, and it's so exciting to see them retweeting comments from their users, you know, users helping them to write their stories sort of almost in a crowdsourced way, like, oh, you wrote something wrong, or, you know, I have this fact that you didn't have. I mean, that kind of interaction was not possible in the world where you printed a newspaper once a day and ended up on someone's doorstep. I mean, corrections would appear, you know, a few days later. Mm-hmm. The cost of making a mistake in print is way higher than the cost of making a mistake in a blog post. And I think that interaction with a
the lawyers audience, would tell you otherwise.
Well, I mean, it depends on what kind of mistake you're making. There are certain kind of mistakes that are very, very costly. There are other kinds of mistakes that maybe too much of the old world of copy editing and print has come online, and maybe we should be a little bit more lax with some of those restrictions that aren't going to cause, suing you into the ground.
Sure. And, I mean, I think Twitter is also good with just iterative reporting. I mean, we had reporters covering the BP oil spill or Occupy or, you know, the kind of union fight in Wisconsin, and people would give, like, literally, here, I'll take you out on my boat, or you can come stay at my house, or, by the way, I have the inside dope on that. And it's because they were in a constant dialogue with the reporters. So it's great for all of that, and obviously the Arab Spring stuff, we saw full well how important it was there. And I don't think it's an either-or, and I think you're not just driving people. You know, if you're just putting up links to your own stories, people will quickly, you know, kick you out of their feed, basically.
Right.
So you can't just, it can't just serve as a self-promotional thing as well.
I think you touched on a good point there, which is that I think the media organizations that thrive have to be communities as well. There has to be some offline component where you're helping people get together, people of a like mind, people of like interests. I think all of us here are doing that in some form or another.
So, you know, I guess sort of going back to the technology that we're using today to sort of publish our stories, I think if you sort of look around the room, maybe not necessarily this room, but let's say you're on the subway or on an airplane or at the airport just walking around, everyone's sort of looking at their mobile devices, right? And, I mean, that's just a much larger issue because we're occupying our idle time by, let's say, playing Angry Birds or something. But we're not taking the time to actually consume news. I mean, we are to a certain extent if you're just sort of flipping through Twitter. But headlines can only do so much. And let's be honest, I mean, most of those headlines are a little bit sensationalized once in a while just to get you to click to the link. So how do we combat that? How do we sort of combat the need to play Angry Birds instead of actually educating ourselves?
So there was a Pew report that came out a few months ago, and basically it said the number one use of tablets is email. The number two use is news reading. It is only slightly behind email, and after that, games and other things. So, I mean, I think there's really good research out there that suggests that actually phone increased the amount of time that people read.
I do think, to your point, and I'm blanking on the New Yorker writer that writes about this so well, so perhaps you'll remember, Chris, but I think there is a sort of, are we rewiring our brains to just be too frenetic and not to really be able to concentrate anymore? I think there's that problem. But I agree that, the upside of the uses you can get for it, if you can keep that, ADD part under control, are wonderful.
I think we're going to see a huge sort of industry crop up around how to help people manage that, not just curate the content that they're, seeing on the tablet, but, how to really create some new mental models around how to kind of deal with that inundation and that sort of ADD kind of behavior, because it is going to take a toll. We just don't know. It's going to take a few years before we know kind of what the impact is.
I think what we are now is impatient. We're impatient for a good experience. We've been led to expect a high signal-to-noise ratio. And I think, Mark, I think your technology is sort of going to take us further down that road where we'll expect that an app like Zeit will give us the best possible news reading experience we could possibly have and hook us up with the stories that we didn't know that we wanted to read. So we have to be very wary of that reader impatience. We have to respect that, I think. And, we can't get away with being I guess, lacks on our story creation. You know, it has to appeal to someone. And luckily, you know, we're in a long tail kind of world where, you know, a lot of what you write will appeal to someone, but it still has to have that quality.
Yeah, Chris, I think discovery is in the same place that search was early on. I mean, when the web first came out, guess what you did? It was serendipity everywhere. You were lucky to find something, and usually you would stumble upon something that was really cool. And then search taught us that, you know, you can type something into a search bar and actually get what you want. This was actually a very novel concept early in the web. And I think discovery is at that phase right now also, where we're being inundated with all this content. At some point, people are going to start to develop expectations when there are actually products that can curate all that content automatically, really. And I think that we're at this very exciting phase where these companies are coming out, discovery around people, around content, around places, around things to do. And I think this is going to be a huge wave in the next 5 years.
So, Mark, I do have a question, but before I get to that, we will be taking questions from the audience soon. So if you'd like to line up at one of the mics, you know, we'll get to you in a few minutes. And just remember that we're looking for some short, just sort of clever one question. But, Mark, to your point about discovery, at what point do you say these algorithms can only do so much to bubble up the content that matters to you? You know, there's a lot of clutter out there.
I mean, imagine you had, you know, lots of people reading everything that was produced every day, and they knew everything about you. And as they showed you things, it would get smarter and smarter and smarter. I mean, this is what we're trying to build in computers. We're trying to build a bunch of editors that go read everything every day, learn about your preferences, and try to deliver it to you. I mean, this is much like search is still, you know, continuing to get better, and sometimes you type stuff into Google or Bing and it fails. Sometimes discovery will fail now. In fact, oftentimes it will just fail now because we're at the beginning stages. But we're getting closer and closer to making that dream of someone giving you really interesting stuff to read reality.
But
and
Mark,
I was going to say, it's not just about things that are perfectly tuned to you. It's sometimes about giving you something serendipitous, right? It's sometimes about giving you something you didn't know that you wanted. And you're like, oh, wow, how interesting. I had no idea I found armadillos so interesting. I actually found something on site one day about armadillos in Washington, D.C. It was fascinating.
Mark, that was what I was going to ask, was about, like, where, what is the role of serendipity within that, and how do you kind of foster that? Because to me, you know, when with the power of the algorithms, you know, determining kind of what it is that I'm going to see or be exposed to, I also want that serendipity as well. So how do you...
I would say discovery is not discovery unless it has both personalization, like knowing you really well, and some sort of guided serendipity. So the idea is that, you know, it's not just random stuff from the web, but stuff that you're pretty likely to like, even though we're not sure about some aspects. I mean, Zeit takes into account not just things that you like, people that you like, publications that you like, but style of writing that you like. I like long-form pieces, so I'm really likely to like a long-form piece from a publication I like about hockey, even though I'm not really a big fan of hockey.
I think another important component of all this is that we haven't really discussed is social. Is, you know, it's almost a peer pressure to know what all of your friends are reading and to have read it before you see them again. You know, if you can, you know, time was when you'd appear by the water cooler and, you know, a friend would unleash three or four stories that you hadn't read that morning. Well, you know, now you can keep up with their Twitter feed and make sure that you've read all those stories before you get to the water cooler. I don't know if you guys are fans of Portlandia. I love the sketch where they're competing with each other for what they've read. Did you read this? Did you read that? Did you read the latest New Yorker? I love that sketch. I think that's the world that we're in with Twitter, is that there's an increasing amount of peer pressure to know everything your social circle knows.
Is it to know the headline, or is it to know the story,
well,
though? I think that's the question,
I think,
right?
It's to bluff your way enough through the story. That
Now, there's also a danger in all of that, I think, which is that we think of our feed or our social group as the larger world. And the more we're fed by algorithms or by feeds that we construct, just one viewpoint or one type of thing, I mean, it's part of what's going on in our politics, I think, is that, you know, we're being divided into at least two or maybe three camps, and pretty much people just sort of read the things that they already agree with, which isn't really the best way to have a constructive conversation about our democracy.
So how do you deal with that at Mother Jones? I mean, it's...
I mean, how do I deal with it personally? Is I try and construct my feed so it's not just that, but and try and engage with people that I don't, wouldn't typically think that I would necessarily agree with. But I do think that it's most obviously seen in politics, but I think really when there's a few things that our entire country can talk about, like maybe Mad Men and maybe American Idol, and everything else is sort of further and further segmented. I mean, there has been something lost with not sitting down and watching Walter Cronkite on the evening news. That model had its flaws, but there was sort of a national conversation at least, you know, once an evening.
Mm. Okay. Well, on that, I think it's our time is up. And as a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inform, Connect Your Intellect. And tonight we're hosting the Digital Publishing, the End of Print, with Claire Jeffrey, Editor-in-Chief of Mother Jones, Lainey Witkenek, Chief Community Officer at Federated Media, Mark Johnson, CEO of Zeit, and Chris Taylor, Deputy Editor of Mashable. And I'm Peter Haw, Managing Editor of TechCrunch. I think we have a couple questions from the audience.
So my question is, Clara talked about how advertising subsidizing media has made people not get its value. The argument would be that that's going to get even worse over time. The young generation now feels like media should be free, content should be free. So why aren't media stepping up and educating people about the value of what they're selling versus just trying to find new ways to make money off of advertising?
I mean, I think they try, but as Bill Keller found, and I, you know, I think that he was in part trolling and in part intemperate in his remarks, but I think you also sound like a whiner to a certain extent. You're like, wait, we're important, pay for us, please. So, you know, I think that we do it. It's easier for nonprofits. NPR has pledge drives. We kind of have a same type of thing. But I actually think that you know, under 25 has started to get this again. It's really the people who are in their 30s now who are sort of the you know, they're the ones who came up with the sort of revolutionary, you know, information wants to be free, and they took that to mean literally not crossing boundaries, but free. And it's like, well, you know, some kinds of information have no cost associated with them, but most that have value have value.
It's the paywall of guilt.
Yes, really paywall of guilt.
The strongest
one. Much better.
One.
I mean,
that's
shorter.
What a pledge drive is.
Shorter, yes.
Awesome.
Hi. The title here tonight is Digital Publishing, the End of Print. Well, I guess it must be the end of print because you haven't discussed it at all for the whole evening pretty much. You've been discussing tablets and the digital model. So my question is, will print go away even more? There's been a decline of newspapers and magazine. Is that going to continue for the next 10 years? And what do you see out there as far as print for the next 10 years? Thank you.
So I think, you know, I think there's always a place for print. It will always exist. You know, TV did not kill the radio. TV and radio did not kill newspapers. There used to be much more of a thriving newspaper culture in America. I think it got a little complacent. You know, you can tell from my accent, I'm not from around here. I grew up in the UK where we have, you know, roughly 10 national newspapers in cutthroat competition with each other at all times. And I came to the U.S. and I found each city had one or two newspapers that were in this sort of very genteel kind of competition that really wasn't cutthroat at all. I think what's happened is that market is now kind of catching up with reality. The best newspapers will absolutely thrive. It's a Darwinian process. I think the newspapers that look the best, you know, have the best design, have the most beautiful way of presenting information, will thrive. And you know, the same is true of magazines. If they give you a good experience, they make you want to pick them up week after week to subscribe to them, to leaf through them. To not have to jump from article to article, which, you know, I know a lot of young people have a serious problem with because they're not used to that kind of behavior. Jumping is just, you know, jump to page A16, why? You know, why couldn't you just print the rest of the article there? So, you know, these sort of vestigial, you know, organs are going to be removed from the organism, I think, in a very Darwinian sense. the best newspapers will thrive, and they'll still be here, I think, in 2040, 2050.
Chris, just very quickly, I mean, certainly TV did not kill radio, but the tape was killed by the CD, which was killed by MP3s, and I'm not sure which analogy is more apt here.
And yet vinyl came back.
And yet vinyl came back.
Condé Nast is reprinting Domino magazine in
Thank
paper
God.
Form, right? Which is a great magazine, I know. Thank God, it was right. But, I mean, I think that there are examples of how print have, the brands of print have become so strong that, you know, even though the actual printed magazine that was in circulation has gone away, they're still looking for different ways to surface content and potentially to produce new print artifacts from that brand. So I think there's a possibility.
I mean, I think everyone's going to have to just think about how much longer and for what kinds of things it makes sense to send dead trees around the city or the country or the world. For some things, that might make sense, but for a lot of things, it probably won't make sense. And as the digital devices get cheaper and better and more just easier to use in every sense, I think a lot of what we think of as print, which is different than the kinds of journalism and storytelling that used to be on paper, will go away. But the curated experience of either a great magazine or a great newspaper, that will live on because that has value. It just might not be on dead trees.
If I may say one more thing, I'd like to put in a plug for the SF Public Press, which is a new newspaper here in San Francisco where they're trying to produce a newspaper that has no advertising in it. It's entirely, you know, paid model. There we go. And, you know, it's available in bookstores. And it's now available on the street, and they're able to sell it on the street, even though people are walking past with only credit cards in their pockets, because they're using the Square device in their iPhones to take payments. And this I think, may well revolutionize the newspaper industry.
Claire, I wanted to ask you, I mean, you have a stake in both right now, both print, dead trees, and on the web. So at what point do you say to yourself, you know, print really isn't doing much for us anymore? And you just say, well, we're going to have to close this up and just put everything behind a paywall online. If you're
I think the key to the print audience is it's your loyal audience. It's your audience that pays for you, right? So, you know, if you're a nonprofit, that also might come with additional donations. But if you're a Condé Nast publication, it comes with a certain amount of loyalty, a set revenue base that you can rely on. So it's not yet an either-or. I mean, we now make more money on digital advertising than print advertising, but then we were never, you know, Vogue magazine with, you know, 800 pages of ads or anything. So for now, I think you've got to kind of try and compete on both platforms and others.
Okay. Hi, just a side comment. The part of the world I come from, print is still growing, and the World Print Congress now actually holds conferences in India. So it's not that bad. I just wanted to highlight that Chris was saying that UK print is still very alive. In Asia, print is still very alive, both in China as well as India. So we shouldn't probably ride the obituary of the print medium. Having said that, my question was something else. What Facebook and Twitter actually have done is they've solved the plumbing problem, which is the distribution problem. And in past, you actually needed a large print organization which would take care of distribution. And I worked for the world's largest newspaper called Times of India, where, you know, I realized that the company was actually a distribution company and did a great job in distribution. What is very interesting now with Facebook, Twitter, and a whole bunch of Zeit and others is that they have solved the distribution problem and the plumbing problem for the journalists. So do you see a situation where individual journalists actually will become bigger brands than a CNN or some of the other brands which have spent so many years actually building that, because a journalist today no longer actually needs, you know, a distribution or a large house, apart from the lawyer point that you made. That was one point. The second part is, how do you see publishing, actually newsroom activities changing because of the current situation? Because in the past, there was an editor and there was a sub-editor and there was a large amorphous organization. But now it's very quick and, you know, all of that changes. So I just wanted to hear your views on that.
Actually, your first question is pretty interesting. So, yeah, what is going to keep someone from just spinning off and just starting their own blog?
Well, that's already happened, right, with people like Om Malik and Andrew Sullivan is under the Daily Beast, but only for now, you know. But it will. It's mostly for people who practice a certain kind of thing. I don't think you're going to see people running into a war zone too much by themselves. I mean, that does happen to a certain extent, but not the really in-depth, prolonged coverage. So it's more than just lawyers. I mean, it costs, I think, the Times. You know, it was something, I don't want to, something close to $1 million, you know, per person at the height of the war to put people in Iraq. I mean, just with all the infrastructure and insurance and, you know, so we can send, people can go over there uninsured and without lawyers, and that has always happened to some extent too, but it's just different levels of coverage.
Right. Yeah, the barrier to entry for foreign correspondents has never been lower. I mean, we've seen just this year iPhone documentaries come out of Syria.
Right.
You know, this is the first visual record that's really coming out from, you know, trusted journalistic sources from Syria being broadcast on Al Jazeera. I think you are going to see a lot more of that sort of freelance relationship between the journalists on the ground, who will all have the tools because they're cheap enough, and the editors become more of an aggregator of those freelancers.
Sure. Got a couple more minutes, mm-hmm. So a couple more questions.
Yes, I suspect you'd prefer a tweet to a question, but it looks to me that it doesn't make any difference what the delivery method is. I use them both, or all of them, whatever they are. But the casualty, it seems to me, evident from the panel discussion, is journalism. Investigative reporting is gone, and it costs money. In other words, people have to have enough people on the staff, and they have to assign them intelligently. I mean, if you don't believe it, just walk out the street and walk around and look in the door sills, and you see that downtown San Francisco is our current state asylum because we don't have any reporting on the fact that we have no care or no laws that allow for the treatment of the mentally ill. So where is investigative reporting? Where is journalism? And is it going to be the complete casualty of what you're talking about?
I completely disagree. I mean, one of the great things, so Zeit helps you to find content from all over. It's amazing to me when you find some obscure blog from some guy who, you know, writes once a month and has spent hours, days, weeks, months, maybe a year on a story. I think there's investigative journalism going on all over the place. I think people get passionate about issues and go do their own research. I mean, I think one thing we haven't talked about on this panel is citizen journalism. Hmm. And that's a wave that's coming. And as Chris said, the cost of the production is going way down. And the passion of the people is going way up. And I think you're going to see a lot of really interesting investigative reporting not coming from the CNNs of the world, but coming from people out here in the audience.
Okay. I think we can have a much larger discussion about this afterwards during the reception, but we have, I think, time for one or two more questions.
One question that concerns me is actually the loss of intellectual and cultural stimulation on people that don't, for example, have a touch or an iPad or the different type of media. There is a large social class that does not have access to these sort of things. Another reason is also children. As a child, I was exposed to Mother Jones because I read it in the dentist office, and I liked what I read. The magazine Wilson Quarterly, laying around at my uncle's house, picked it up and read and got exposed and realized I like naval history. One of the things I worry about with digital publishing is that you're going to see people who normally would have been reached by print being left out and being left behind. And also another thing is that how many people have had elementary schools ask, please send your child with an article or with a newspaper to cut out and we'll discuss these different things in class. How is this problem going to be addressed? Because I see it as there's going to be an inferiority of people who cannot achieve this and not be exposed and be able to develop.
I think that's the digital divide, as it's, you know, kind of somewhat glibly called, is a huge problem. And I think it is made worse by digital media, and I think that, you know, people who can think nothing of having multiple digital delivery devices don't consider that enough. And I don't know if there really is a great solution for that right now. I mean, I think it kind of goes to broader societal problems. I mean, a lot of people are making a lot of paper money off things that are around this universe. We'll see what actually happens once this latest bubble bursts. But for right now, there's so much euphoria around all of these companies and all of these products, and that doesn't necessarily shake out to be the best for the most people.
Okay. Well, I'd like to I get your opinion on, I'm going to come at this from more on the technical side. And I'd like your opinion on two aspects of the what you're talking about as the death of print. The first has to do with the discussion has centered around the inability of the magazine format to take hold, or at least to have people pay for the magazine format. And one way of looking at it is to say that, sorry, folks, your magazine format is Gutenberg 1.1. I mean, you haven't moved, you've hardly moved off a scanned page. And yet the technology is just wonderful underneath all of that. You could do so much more. And if you did, maybe we'd pay for it. The other side of the question is, there's a lot more to print than just magazines. What about, for example, what do you guys think about is going to happen with books? What do you think is going to happen with textbooks? What do you think about the group of companies like Inkling who are doing some marvelous things with the new technology in the textbook area and so on and so on?
I mean, here. I think we've said it many times on the panel is we've got this amazing device with a lot of power and a tablet. You've got this amazing device in your pocket. It's a phone. It has more processing power than you ever had in your life.
So and why are you giving us Gutenberg 1.1?
I think people are going to have to innovate, and they are. Inkling, I think you cited some examples, and you're just going to see more and more of it.
Okay. I think our time is up. And, obviously we can have a much larger discussion outside. But, here at Inform, we like to end all of our events by asking our speakers the following question. Claire, Mark, Laney, and Chris, what are your 60-second ideas to change the world? I'll start with Chris.
Access to information. I think that is the essential root of everything. Information means education. Education means making better life decisions. Better life decisions is better for the planet as a whole. It helps keep the population down. It helps keep gender bias problems down. It all comes back to having the information to make your choices. So The more access we have to not just the internet, but to the libraries of information that need to be put onto the internet, that could save the world.
I hope that more people look towards the future to fix problems than lament the past. I mean, this panel is much about that, right, is talking about the death of print. Well, maybe we shouldn't be crying about the death of print. Maybe we should be getting really excited about what's ahead of us. I mean, Chris had a great example with Square, like engendering this new era of print. I mean, technology is all around us. We live in the Silicon Valley. This is really exciting, and there's lots of exciting things that are going to happen. And I hope that people growing up in this generation get really excited about the technology that's in front of them.
Wayne?
I would say a focus on clarifying intent, that so much of our miscommunication in this world happens because we're not... We look at people and we look at ideas in terms of position and not intent. And so taking the time to ask other people or to process information through the lens of intent, I think, would allow for a lot more forward thinking and progress. If you think about like an emoticon, as funny as emoticons are, they're actually a little way to express intent, right, in communication. So I think clarifying intent is key to a successful future.
Claire?
If I was going to change the world, I'd solve climate change and put more women in charge. But if I was going to try and change media, I think one of the things that's really missing is just transparency about revenue, about intent, as you say, about the end goals of an organization, about where they're getting their money from and where they're spending it. Nobody knows how many, all the reported traffic numbers are basically that, self-reported, and often if you know something about that person's business, you know they're horribly, horribly inflated. Some kind of actual assessment of what is going on and who is benefiting from it.
Sure. Well, I think that wraps it up, and I'd like to give a big round of applause to Claire Jeffrey, Mark Johnson, Lainey Whitknecht, and Chris Taylor for sharing their thoughts with us tonight. And with that, now this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.